Andy.
Thanks, Adam. Very comprehensive and covered a lot of stuff there in a really synthesized way, actually. You did it very well and very understandably. I guess it's from myself, it's a question really. Now I read Lenin and read What Is to Be Done and things like State and Revolution and so on as well. But the question is, I sort of like two sides of the same coin, really. I think we've got, we understand that the reason that the Russian Revolution was not successful is that it could never have been successful. There was no mass revolutionary consciousness within that society at that time. It was essentially a peasantry, really, that was, the mass of the people were peasants. They weren't actually working class. There was some industry in Russia, but essentially the vast majority of the people were peasants, farmers and so on, and just living this sort of subsistent life, very grueling, hard life. But the other thing is as well is that I think this is me actually saying this, is my argument about socialism and the a way that socialism could ever really take root is that it has to be about a mass revolutionary consciousness kind of coinciding, sort of alliding with actually existing circumstances, which would, would tend to generate and rise in the sense of having like mass working class action, whatever form that might take, I don't know. It would be whatever that is at the time, but that would give a sense of an impetus towards revolutionary socialism. So my question, I guess, is sort of like coming back to, feet, trying to put the feet back on the ground, is for us as an organization, on one hand, I sort of take some comfort from that because it seems to me as though, we're a million miles away from any mass revolutionary consciousness. And the question I have really is about, well, we make the argument that actually capitalism has now got to the stage where the forces of production are in place for the implementation of socialism, but we're not able to convince anybody about that. We seem to have a problem. There just seems to be a sort of a missing link we're not able to get across. And so, yeah, I mean, it's on one hand, it's a sort of a comfort in one way, but it's also a sort of a real frustration. I just wondered what you think about that. I mean, I think Lenin and his history, most of us, I think, at this meeting are fairly familiar with, really. But I think we need to just sort of use the learning that that they went through, Lenin and his cohorts, for our own sort of practice and sort of whatever we do in the future. All right, thanks, Adam.
Okay, before dealing with that point, you think what I was trying to argue was that the Russian Revolution was a successful revolution. It wasn't a successful socialist revolution. So, I mean, this was the sort of twofold nature I was trying to bring up. I mean, Russian Revolution was successful. I mean, it was quite a thoroughgoing anti-feudal, if you like, or anti-Tsarist revolution. I mean, they shot all the members of the royal family, so there was no chance of any restoration. I mean, the French revolutionaries didn't do that, and the landlords were completely dispossessed and exiled. It cleared away all the barriers to the future development of the Russian Revolution. Was a successful revolution to clear the way for capitalism. But what it wasn't was a successful socialist revolution. It wasn't even a socialist revolution. I don't even think it really was an attempt at a socialist revolution either. So I mean, that was one point. I think at that time, Marx and I think the early members of the party thought that socialism was inevitable. It was inevitable that the working class would win control of political power. But I mean, we can't maintain that today. And I think wasn't this the theme of Keith Graham's talk at the summer school? If socialism is not inevitable, that means it's much more important. Arguing the case for socialism. But I don't think we should fall into the opposite trap of assuming that we have to convince the whole working class to become socialists. I mean, it'll be capitalism must be working towards this as well. I see we've got two other people there who want to speak. Howard.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks. That was superlative, frankly. I don't think it's the case that everybody here, including me, knew all about that already. Not at all. It was really sort of excellently put together. And it was sort of mind-blowing, really, to be reminded that Marx and Engels, many decades before, had predicted the plight of someone like Lenin. They predicted what would happen if somebody like Lenin led the kind of revolution he led. That was remarkable, really, when you think about it, without having any idea that where it might happen and who would do it, etc. So that's the first comment I'd make. Second, I noticed you managed not to mention the word Trotsky at all. And fair enough, you did mention Trotskyism, that, you know, in the 70s and 80s, we had to defend ourselves against the Trotskyists. But Lenin is often sort of associated with Trotsky with Lenin. And it's interesting. I don't know whether you can say something about the relationship between Lenin's ideas and those of Trotsky, because modern-day Trotskyists tend to also say they're Leninists, as though they were sort of more or less one and the same thing. I mean, they say they're Marxists as well, we know, but that they associate Trotsky with Lenin, as opposed to Stalin, of course. Whereas people who call themselves Leninists sometimes anyway, and not infrequently, steer clear of Trotsky, steer clear of the kind of thing that Trotsky himself, the kind of ideas he was to develop after the death of Lenin, and once he'd been sort of made persona non grata by Stalin and eventually assassinated. So I wonder if you could say something about the relationship between the ideas of Lenin and those of Trotsky, and how they are sort of seen by, should we say, the modern left.
Of course, Trotsky wasn't a Bolshevik originally. In fact, when Lenin's ideas came out in 1902 in that pamphlet, notorious pamphlet, in What Is to Be Done, Trotsky wrote a critique against it. He said this would lead to a dictatorship, and we must have democratic organization. But he also put forward another theory that all the social democrats and social revolutionaries and others thought that when the Tsar was overthrown, there would be established a democratic, capitalist republic. Trotsky argued at that time that, well, if the working class did get power, did overthrow the Tsar at that time, they would they wouldn't stop at capitalism. They would then proceed to what he called socialist direction. They would nationalize industry and run things like that. So he was in favor, if you like, of going for socialism as he understood it. But in fact, of course, Trotsky never in any of his writings gave any indication that he made a distinction between socialism and state capitalism. So Trotsky was advocating, if you like, a revolution in 1905, that sort of time, if there was one, to establish state capitalism. I mean, Trotsky didn't, in fact, join the Bolsheviks until August 1917. I mean, the Trotskyists, you know, could be more important, obviously, than...
You're muted. You're just muted now, Adam. We can't hear anything at all.
Sorry to interrupt here, Adam. If you can hear us, would it be an idea just to log out and log back in again?
Yeah, good idea. Yeah.
Sorry to butt in here, but would it be worth just to keep things going to hear what Darren wants to say?
No, but Adam would want to hear that as well, wouldn't he?
Oh, I guess so. Okay.
He'll be logging in a second, so
trying to be helpful.
Just give him a minute. Right, he's coming in. Right, you're in, Adam. How's your sound? You can hear. No, we're still getting this static. It's really bad static. We can barely hear you.
So what do you recommend?
Oh, that's well. I recommend you fixed. You fixed it. You've just fixed it.
Maybe put the plug in, did I?
Yeah. You put the plug in. Yeah, you stopped strangling the cat or something.
Anyway, okay.
Can you remember what you were saying before?
I was asking a question about Trotsky. You didn't hear me say that Trotsky wasn't a Bolshevik, did you?
Yeah, we did hear that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, anyway, the Trotskyists claim then that when Lenin came back to Russia in April 1917 and announced that the program of the Bolshevik Party was now not, you know, a democratic republic, but the actual capture of power, you know, they claim that Lenin had become a Trotskyist, or Lenin had gone over to Trotsky's view. And then, of course, in the meantime, Trotsky had gone on over to Lenin's view, so that they, you know, they make Leninism and Trotskyism, you know, the same. Because when Lenin died in 1924, there was a power struggle as to who was going to be his successor, and you can see the cult of Lenin was established. I mean, this would be a proof it wasn't a socialist revolution as well. You know, fancy embalming his body and putting it in a mausoleum, and you know. Anyway, so Stalin wrote a book, a pamphlet called Leninism, and Trotsky wrote another one called you know Lessons of October, and they blamed each other, and eventually, you know, Stalin won. I think he was always going to win, actually, for all sorts of reasons. I mean, Trotsky hadn't been a Bolshevik, an old Bolshevik. He was Jewish, and Stalin was more working class than Trotsky. But of course, the official Stalinists also claimed to be Leninists. But I mean, their arguments, you know, once Russia had been established, when you get to the 30s and 40s, I mean, they were just, you know, the state ideology. So that was another brand of Leninism. And I suppose then you also got, of course, the Maoists in the 1960s, and Maoist parties call themselves, Marxist Leninist. But there's also sort of revisionist people who are, as I mentioned them, they're arguing that, you know, Lenin was just a more or less orthodox left wing social democrat operating in the sort of political conditions of Russia. That's why he had to have organized, you know, secretly and so on, and that he was a social democrat. But when once he got power, he certainly ceased to be a social democrat because he abandoned democracy, and you know, he was in favour of a one party state. But I must confess that going back to that period, we're talking about the 70s and 80s. Most of the people claiming to be Leninists were were Trotskyists, and I think. Even we accepted the Trotskyist narrative about Lenin becoming a Trotskyist and this sort of thing. So maybe the situation is not quite as simple as that. You know that some people say that Stalin was a better Bolshevik than Trotsky. So the Trotskyists claim to be Leninists. They proclaim this, don't they? That they are. Whereas these days, the mainstream communist party doesn't do this to the same extent. Well, I see they have revived the hammer and sickle, which they dropped at one point. But so there are still Leninists and Leninists around. I suppose what these revisionists are trying to do is just to try and rescue Lenin from what happened in Russia under Stalin. I mean, I don't suppose Lenin would have had people writing, poems about the sun shining over his house and so on. But he was pretty ruthless in power. I think he justified this to himself and said, "Look, we represent the vanguard of the working class. We've got to hold on to power, and we're entitled to use the most ruthless methods to do this, including shooting and imprisoning political opponents." Right. So, is that all right, Howard, for the answer to your question? But the next person I'd see here is sorry?
Okay. Yeah, thanks for that, then.
Yeah. Okay, so, Darren, it's your...
Hi, Gary, Adam, thanks for the talk. Just really a quick question, I guess, because, you obviously were... You touched upon when the Bolsheviks seized power that... Very quickly, Lenin in his writings tried to draw this distinction between, socialism and communism, against, accusations from the left, the ultra-left, or left communists, that what the Bolsheviks were actually undertaking would eventually lead to state capitalism. Kind of tangentially linked to that, I'm kind of curious when it kind of entered like Leninist politics and entered kind of like the debate or the discussion of the class nature of the Soviet Union, the business of Marx's letter to, I think it was Vera Sisulich, one of the early Russian Marxists. It was the 1870s, where I'm just curious when this letter became sort of public and was kind of weight was added to it. Where in the course of correspondence, and I believe it was a very short off-the-cuff letter, Marx mentioned because of the lack of development in Russia in the 19th century, and because of the Zemstrom system, the peasant commons, that he kind of implied in this letter to Sisulich that. Perhaps Russia didn't have to go through capitalist development because of like the socialized production, socialized organization of the peasantry. Sorry, Brooklyn's very noisy this time of day. I was just curious when that, was that something that sort of arose within like the Soviet Communist Party, the early Bolsheviks, the later Bolsheviks, where that was their kind of rationalization for the course they took, or am I attributing something to them, which is not the case, and it's more the case that this is something that maybe sort of Leninist academics in the West have maybe tried to sort of clutch to as a means to kind of rationalize, what the Russian Revolution turned into. So I was curious if you knew about that, when the letter became public, when it sort of had carried weight, and what kind of discussion that generates. Cheers.
Yeah, but I mean, but, you know, when I said that, you know, the Russian revolutionaries called or called themselves Narodniks, and that they all had a sort of socialist tinge. I mean, there were people in Russia. I mean, and even at the time of the Russian Revolution, who thought that Russia could avoid capitalism, could pass to some sort of system which wouldn't be capitalist, but which they thought was socialist, and it would be based, you know, like you say, on the peasant communes. But I think, you know, Marx was, you know, was making the point, which I think could be a valid point, incidentally, that if there had been a socialist revolution, you know, a world socialist revolution, or a revolution, socialist revolution in Europe, then there was no reason why Russia would have to pass through capitalism. It could pass to socialism on the basis of, you know, on the basis of the, you know, peasant commune, and then develop industry and so on. I think incidentally that could have been the case in 1917. I mean, we can say that Russia wasn't ripe for socialism in 1917, but the world was ripe for socialism in 1917. So if the world had gone socialist in 1917, so, you know, so could Russia. The argument is that Russia couldn't have gone socialist in 1917 on its own, and it, you know, had this argument about socialism in one country. But I doubt whether the Bolsheviks and Stalinists would have gone along with you know, the idea that Russia could have developed socialism on its own on the basis of what Marx wrote, you know, to these Narodniks at the time, because Lenin, you know, Lenin's work, The Development of Capitalism in Russia, which he wrote in 1899, is an attack on that theory. It says, you know, Russia cannot avoid going through the, you know, the capitalist stage. Russia cannot go straight to socialism. Capitalism has to develop in Russia in the circumstance. I can't see them, you know, Stalin sort of, you know, claiming Marx as a justification. I think the socialism in one country thing, I mean, Lenin was ambiguous on this because he did describe Russia as socialist. He thought that the nationalized sector of the Russian economy was socialist, you know, the state-owned industries. So, and once he'd made this, say, this false distinction between socialism and communism, and made socialism virtually state capitalism. I mean, state capitalism in one country is possible, and that's what happened. I can see Andy.
Yeah, can you hear me? Is Darren and Adam, have you finished on that point? Darren, did you want to speak to Adam on that point further?
No, I'm fine. I mean, I may come up with another question afterwards, but no, I'm fine. Cheers. Yeah.
Comprehensive as your talk was, Adam, it just raises more and more questions for me, really, about this sort of, it's a fascinating period of history, and I don't mean to be too granular or too train spotterish about it. But one thing you didn't mention during the course of the talk was the, unless I missed it, I may have missed it, and I apologise if I did, was the influence of the Mensheviks, the group that was led by Martov, and or Martov. And I've always thought, before I ever came across the SPGB, you know, half a lifetime ago, that the Mensheviks were sort of nearest, in my opinion, really, to the SPGB in their outlook. I don't know the full kind of policy of the Mensheviks, but I just thought it'd be interesting because, I mean, you obviously, you know, you're very, you know more than I do on this subject. So is there something you could tell us about the Mensheviks and their role in this historical sort of period?
Well, I think everybody knows why they're called Mensheviks and Bolsheviks, don't they? That in the Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Party, I don't know when it was now, 1906, there was a vote on some key issue, actually on this Vanguard Party one, and the Bolsheviks won. The Bolsheviks means the majority, and the Mensheviks means the minority, and that's the names which they becoming known as. But in fact, I think up until the First World War, the Mensheviks were the majority. They were just they were social democrats, like the German Social Democratic Party,
they claimed to be Marxists.
Yes, yes. They did. That's what I'm saying. So did the Germans.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, what we need to be clear on here is this was a revolutionary period. It wasn't like they're like the German Democrats, social Democrats of today. Yeah. They were like these were serious people. They wanted they meant it like socialist yeah. revolution. They meant it.
Yeah, but I hadn't got as far as the First World War yet. So most Mensheviks, like most Social Democrats, supported their government in the First World War. So so the Mensheviks in Russia, most of them, were in favour of the war, even after the overthrow of the Tsar and a new government came in. Which was, had Mensheviks in it. They were in favour of continuing the war. This is the majority of the Mensheviks. There was a minority known as the Menshevik Internationalists, of which Martov was one of the representative who were opposed to the war. And in fact, their policy was that you should overthrow the Tsar, you should overthrow the provisional government. But what you should have is a coalition government of all the socialists in inverted commas, not a one party dictatorship. By the Bolshevik Party, so they were in favour, if you like, of I don't know whether it was a realistic prospect of some sort of democratic system existing in Russia. The Constituent Assembly and this, and they weren't the only Russian revolution. Incidentally, there was another group of non-Marxist Russian revolutionaries, called the Social Revolutionaries. But anyway, in the end. As I pointed out, the Bolsheviks, because they were this disciplined organization, they were able to seize power and hold on to it. And I think Lenin had a bit of a soft spot for Martov, so he allowed him to go into exile. Otherwise, he would have probably been shot or sent to a concentration camp. In fact, Martov, drew attention to these, writings that Marx. And Engels had done in 1847. So what would happen if a revolutionary leader or a revolutionary party got power before the conditions were ripe for establishing socialism? I mean, Martov was the person that drew attention to this at the time. So
I read a few things by Martov, he was sort of. I didn't know about the support for the war and all.
He didn't support the war.
All right. Okay.
The other mentioned supported the war.
He just seemed to me to be very clear-minded about this should be a more democratic revolutionary process, and also the understanding that you can't really have a socialist revolution based on a peasants' revolt.
Well, yes, but we should be careful. I mean, the Trotskyists call us Mensheviks, but we're not, are we? The Mensheviks were like the pre-war German Social Democratic Party, but they were reformists in the end. And last year, only a minority of them who weren't, and they had a better analysis of what was going on. But when the Bolsheviks got power, something had to be done just to keep the population alive. So, they were the only people that were able to take all these dictatorial measures and so on, to actually go and...
Yeah, yeah, because they were democratic, democratic centralism, tight discipline, yeah, all that sort of thing, wasn't it? Yeah, and they drilled that into their cadre, and they were able to take power in that respect.
Andy, listen, there isn't a chair, and I think you're taking advantage of that fact by interrupting all the time, so I don't think you're being very fair. So I think you should just confine yourself.
Oh. I hope that hasn't killed everything off. Anybody else got anything to say? Did you want to come back again, Darren? I think you said at one point.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I initially raised my hand because I was kind of going to say what you were saying about how when we talk of the Mensheviks, you obviously clarified about Nakid, how they were kind of a broader organization, and we obviously think of Martov when we think of the Mensheviks, but that was only a minority who, what's interesting about the Mensheviks is that, like you say, they were kind of allowed to leave by Lenin because of old kind of ties, and they initially went to Berlin, where I believe Martov died in the early 20s. He was a relatively young man, and they then went to Paris, and they were in Paris for organizing in Paris for a couple of decades, and then they eventually ended up in America. And like a lot of the Mensheviks, actually ended up being basically criminologists, for the Americans, and there was this weird dynamic that they surviving Mensheviks, like the intellectuals, like was it Nikolaevsky, I think, was one where they actually they kind of still self-described themselves as social democrats in the classic sense, the Second International, but they were providing sort of intellectual kind of cover for the Cold War. And they were actually sort of writing books and academics, and they were actually sort of using their Marxology, horrible term, but to actually explain the class nature of the Soviet Union. But this was actually being used by the Americans and the CIA in the Cold War, which I always kind of found fascinating, because the Mensheviks as an organized grouping still existed up until I believe the late 1930s, 40s, and a lot of their original documents, the Mensheviks ended up in America, and they're in the Hoover Institute. And if people know the Hoover Institute, that's notorious for being this academic center for the Cold War and for American, American sort of interests. So I just thought that was interesting, the trajectory of the Mensheviks over the decades after the revolution. Cheers.
Because some of them wrote history about Russia. I mean, Theodore Dan wrote one, somebody called Abramovich did. Trotsky himself wrote a history of the Russian Revolution, which is worth reading, but only because he's a participant, so he's giving his view as a participant of what happened, not necessarily an accurate description of what happened. But one thing in that book which amused me, there's a chapter which begins, the working class of Petrograd, woke up to find that they'd seized power. He didn't seem to get the irony of that. How could the working class seize power when they've been asleep all night? And it shows that the Bolsheviks regarded themselves, in fact, as the vanguard of the working class. In fact, they regarded themselves as the working class in the end. They knew better the interests of the working class than the working class itself. We still meet these people today, of course. I mean, there's a new organization, isn't there, called the Revolutionary Communist Party, which has revived the hammer and sickle and they're still selling books, you know, about Lenin and SWP, people like that are still claiming to be Leninists. And, right, well, okay, let's have Paddy and then Howard.
A couple of things occurred to me. At one point you said something along the lines of the Bolsheviks were the only... sorry if I'm misquoting you, but you said something like the Bolsheviks were the only party capable of clearing the way completely for capitalism. And I wondered if that was actually true. I think from the point of view of hindsight, you can look back at a series of events and sort of apply a kind of almost teleological analysis. You know, the Bolsheviks took power, they cleared the way for capitalism, therefore the Bolsheviks were necessary to clear the way for capitalism. See what I mean? But I mean, you know, my understanding, and it's really only vague. Every time I read anything about the Russian Revolution, most 90% of the information goes out of my head again. But the impression I had was that at the time, the Bolsheviks, you know, you mentioned the SRs and the Mensheviks. The Bolsheviks weren't the majority of the revolutionaries. They weren't the most popular. They weren't the ones that most peasants voted for. That would be the anarchists and the SRs. They weren't the only Marxists, and they didn't control the Soviets. So their takeover was a minority vanguardist takeover that was completely undemocratic. They basically hijacked somebody else's revolution. And that's my understanding. I mean, tell me if you think I'm wrong. But would the conclusion to draw from all this be that the... one way of justifying the statement that you made would be the only reason that the Bolsheviks were the only party capable of clearing the way for capitalism is that they were the only party ruthless enough to shoot enough people and shoot the entire royal family, as you pointed out. I mean, is that what we're saying here, that they were the only ones ruthless enough to do it, or have I just kind of misunderstood it?
I wasn't going quite that far. I was just saying that, you know, when the Tsar was overthrown, there was a Politburo coming, you know, with chaos, the government couldn't agree, the provisional government couldn't agree even whether to continue the war or not, whether to carry out land reform, whether to, you know, convoke an election to the Constituent Assembly and so on. But the Bolsheviks were the only party that was capable of, if you like, imposing some sort of order. I mean, and they did. I mean, it wasn't anything with socialism, but it was order. And my argument was, I think, that because they were a party of organized on this basis of party professional revolutionaries, you know, disciplined and a top-down structure, that you know, they were able to hold on to power as well. And I mean, they were in power when all these things were, we're done. I mean, you're quite right. In fact, the peasants took things into their own hands and expropriated the nobles and made the land their property. That wasn't the policy of the Bolshevik Party. The Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks, for that matter, were in favour of land nationalisation. The land should belong to the state and be rented out to the peasants. But the peasants took it over and established private peasant ownership of the land, which then the Bolsheviks were forced to accept. But I mean, I can see the point you're making about it being teleological. But the Bolsheviks were ruthless, and they held on to power. And, you know, they and in the end, that was their main thing. Even after they got the economy stabilized, if you like, not on a socialist basis, but they got production going again. I mean, people thought, as I said, that towards the end of the 1920s that they would be overthrown and an openly capitalist government would take over. But I mean, they definitely played a part in being ruthless in making sure that they killed every single member of the Tsarist royal family that they could. That they could find, and the nobles were exiled, the capitalists were exiled, the big capitalists were exiled. But what would have happened otherwise? I mean, capitalism would have developed in Russia one way or the other. Would it have been something like the development of capitalism in India or something like that, or Brazil? But it would have happened. Well, we can see what happened now since 1991, isn't it? I mean, so Russia is now, isn't it, an openly capitalist country? So I suppose it's a bit of a long transition from, well, how many years was it? 70 years were they, with the Bolsheviks in power for? No, do you want to come back on that, Paddy?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Yeah. Howard, if you're going to...
Can I come back to Trotsky? Sorry about this. Trotsky and Trotskyism. I mean, we know a lot of the people in the organizations that sort of owe allegiance to or to Trotsky or Trotskyism and, very keen on quoting him and so on. A lot of the people don't know anything about Trotskyism, really. They're in those organizations because for all sorts of different reasons. They're happy to sort of, to call themselves Trotskyists simply because they're in those organizations. But, two things really. First of all, this theory of permanent revolution that's often associated with Trotsky, and which these organizations do talk about. I mean, where does that come from? Is that something that's a legacy of Lenin, or is it something that Trotsky himself devised? That's the first thing. The second thing is, I wonder whether you think that had Trotsky won the battle with Stalin for power in Russia when Lenin died, whether Russia... remember, in the 1960s, a book was written by political scientist called Alek Nov, which was entitled "Was Stalin Necessary?" I wonder whether you think that if it was Trotsky who'd taken over, but not Stalin, things would have developed in a sort of similar way under Trotsky as they did under Stalin. In obviously not exactly the same, but in a similar way in Russia from the mid 1920s onwards.
Actually, the term and concept of permanent revolution comes from Marx when he was involved in the revolutions in Germany in 1848 and 1849. He was in favor of. If you read the Communist Manifesto, it ends up by talking about the coming bourgeois revolution will be followed by the proletarian revolution. So he was arguing then that's what should happen. Once you start the bourgeois revolution, you should make it permanent, so that it becomes a proletarian revolution. But I mean, he in exile and after the failure of that revolution, he came to revise his opinion on that. And but anyway, Lenin and Trotsky and people, latch on to what Marx said during that period and apply it to to what happens in what happened in Russia. So the permanent revolution would have been, Lenin comes back in April 1917 and says, we're no longer aiming at constitutional, bourgeois democracy. We're aiming at political power for the workers. Therefore, we've got to push the bourgeois revolution, which has already taken place in March, until it becomes the proletarian revolution. So, I mean, that's the theory. I think the one of the attractions for Trotsky is that Trotsky is a bit of a heroic character, isn't he? I mean, he was the leader of the Russian Revolution, and then he gets exiled, and then he ends up the leader of a small sect, not much larger than the SPGB, having to argue whether Russia's state capitalist or a degenerate worker state or so on. But now, to come back to your other point, but what would have happened had Trotsky succeeded instead of Stalin? I think it would have probably been it wouldn't have been so brutal. But the Russian opposition's policy was to develop the state sector, and it would inevitably have meant, you know, taking stuff, resources from you know from the peasantry. So I think capitalism would still have developed under Trotsky, and Trotsky did support Russia, Russia as a national state. But I suppose, Leninism doesn't have to be as brutal as Stalinism. You can look at Cuba, for instance. They still have a vanguard party and leader worship and so on, but they didn't have mass executions and concentration camps and expropriation of the peasantry. But that would have had to have happened, of course, for capitalism to have spread in Russia. But most of the Trotskyist groups, they don't really adhere to the theory of the vanguard party, except that they're organized on that basis, but they claim to stand for a revolution from below as opposed to a revolution from above, by parliamentary Labour Party and social democratic parties and so on. But in fact, their organizational form is similar. They have a central committee, and the central committee presents its thesis to the conference, and the conference has to vote for it, for or against it, or elections to their central committee is from a list, and you if you want to oppose it, you have to put a complete list. It's not like our elections, so they're not organized like a trade union, which is similar to how we're organized. They still are organized as a vanguard party, but they I think the main thing that distinguishes Trotskyism from our point of view is their theory of the transitional program, where you put forward these demands, which capitalism can't concede, in the hope that when they fail, the workers are going to turn to the Trotskyist party to lead them against capitalism. I mean, that's our main criticism, I think, of the Trotskyists. So they basically have got a new theory of reformism, and in the end, I think some of them actually don't believe that the transitional demands can't be achieved, and they really fight for them as they would reformist parties would. I see Freddie wants to say something. Freddie?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. I appreciate the discussion and the debate and comments, etc. tonight. Listen, this isn't so much a question. It's perhaps, I hope, it's taken the way it's intended, and it's to try and be helpful. I recognised, Adam, much of what you were saying tonight, because believe it or believe it not, it's only about 3 or 4 weeks ago. I'm reading a book about Marx. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was trying to cross-reference it, and I came across an old party pamphlet published, I've got it in front of me now. So I'm not. It was published in 2000. Or was reprinted in 2002, and it was about a seminar that had been held at Vercroft College in 1998. And in that, Adam, you had written an article at that time. It's in the pamphlet, as I say. This is coincidental because I was cross-referencing things with a book about Marx I'm currently trying to get through. And your article was actually called "Was Marx Ever a Leninist?" I hope you don't mind me saying that. I'm not trying to embarrass anyone. And I can only think of one ALB, so I'm assuming it's you that did it. So much of what you were saying tonight, Adam, I'd already identified with. And the reason I'm commenting on it just now is that for some of the party members, or some that are maybe here tonight that haven't previously read that pamphlet that arose out of the Firkcroft College and reprinted in 2002, as I said, we'd probably find that there's some considerably helpful information in there. And I would just like to sort of end by, because Steve Coleman had also written an article in that, and if you just bear with me for a second, well, a minute or two longer, in his article, I'm not quoting any of yours right now, Adam, but in his article, the last sort of sentence goes, that was Marx, the man. What we are left with is Marx, the legacy. The legacy of a theory of society which is fundamentally revolutionary, which is absolutely pertinent to the kind of society we are living in today, which is still a capitalist system of society, and a theory which will simply not go away, much as it is derided or declared dead, as long as there is a capitalist society to be analysed, fought against, and replaced by socialism. I think that's just as pertinent today as the article that you wrote about, Adam. So I've certainly appreciated it tonight. And if any other comrades have not here tonight seen that pamphlet, I would recommend that they go to it. So thanks for tonight, Adam.
Okay, thanks. I'm not sure whether that pamphlet is readily available, isn't it? I don't think Mike is here, but it'd be something he produced, write up of what happened at a summer school. Incidentally, of course, the answer to the question is, was Marx a Leninist? Was no? But that's what I was referring to when I said that, Marx in that period of 1948-1949 use the term permanent revolution because he expected the bourgeois revolution to be followed quickly by what he called a proletarian revolution. Right, I think we've more or less exhausted the people asking questions, even if we haven't exhausted the subject. So should we call it a meeting to an end, or this part of the meeting anyway? I can tell you what's on next week if you want. It's a discussion on the report on the Grenfell Tower fire. So it's going to be the basis of the articles in this month's Standard.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, cheers, Adam. Good night, all.